Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, the podcast brought to you by the Construction Index. It's Wednesday, the 17th of June, 2020. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and joining me remotely, of course, is our online news editor, Phil Bishop, the man with his finger on the UK construction industry pulse. Welcome, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things with you?
Yeah, pretty good. I think we're about to have a magnificent thunderstorm down here. It's getting very dark and brooding, and that's just the atmosphere in the office.
Well, we need some of that. I've been using my lack of social life in the past few weeks to get the garden sorted out. We need rain to get
It's like a
growing.
Desert out there. Well, we've had plenty of that down in Devon, and I think we're just about to get some more. So you might see some flashing and hear some thunder in a minute.
Exciting.
Indeed. Talking about dramatic events, I think you've got quite an important story to report this morning, haven't you, Phil?
Yeah, well, the first thing that I wanted to mention, discuss this morning briefly, is the survey that's been done for the Construction Leadership Council by Build UK on expected redundancies, job losses that construction companies are expecting to have in the coming months. And unsurprisingly, it is not good news at all. We already know from numbers from the government last week that there are 679,600, so nearly 680,000 construction jobs have been furloughed during the lockdown, and it was probably quite likely that not all of those would have jobs to go back to in the immediate future, plus a further 800,000 self-employed individuals on state support. So we've got close to 1.5 million UK construction workers, the people in the construction sector, and includes people who work in, I think, in builders' merchant stores and so on.
Yeah.
But 1.5 million people from the sector have been on state support, and not all of them have jobs to go back to. This survey, Build UK, that's been published this morning.
Build UK is the contractors' trade association, basically, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it's a pan. It's got construction companies that are members, and it's got other smaller other federations that are members of Build UK.
Yeah.
So it's got a wide, diverse membership. They have found that 11.4% of employees of construction contractors are likely to be laid off by September. They asked all the members of the organisation and different companies across the industry, how many people, what proportion of your employees do you think you're going to be laying off by September? And the average response amongst contractors, main contractors and specialist contractors, was 11.4%. So that's more than 1 in 10 of people working for UK contractors can expect to lose their jobs by September, which is frightening, shocking, horrifying.
Yeah.
We don't know how many people responded to the survey, so we don't know how accurate it is, but I suspect that it's pretty good. Not the results, but I mean the quality of the survey, and the likelihood of the outcome. And on top of that, they also ask us about apprenticeships and graduate trainees and so on, and it's just bad news there. There's going to be job cuts across the board coming. We've already had announcements from various companies across the industry. The latest, Keltbray, making 300 roles redundant in the next few months. That's 15% of their headcount.
Yeah.
Waite, 8% of their company are going to be laid off. They're looking at Travis Perkins, a builder's merchant giant. They're shutting 165 stores, laying off 2,500 staff. That's about 9% of their workforce.
That's a lot.
JCB, a few weeks ago, said they're letting something like a fifth of their UK workforce go. Marshalls, the paving block and landscaping people, 15% going there. So this is going to be the theme, I think, as people come off or don't come off furlough, as the scheme ends and so on. There's going to be lot of horrible news coming up.
Are there any specific sectors which are especially hard hit or are likely to be especially hard hit? I think we spoke last time, we said that really infrastructure was the, if anything, the saviour of the
sector. I think that's correct. I think it's the correct.
So can we assume that things like commercial construction and maybe house building are going to be the biggest casualties?
I suspect so. I think they're going to bear the brunt of it. Certainly, Keltbray said it would be their built environment sector, division of the business, not the infrastructure division of the business, which is the target of the cost cutting.
And of course, the supply chain will suffer as a result of that, won't it? Because
of course, it's going to knock the whole way through.
There's a graph I'm looking at online. I've only just seen this actually, but it seems to suggest that material suppliers are going to lose almost 15% of their employees. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah, I'm never quite sure with I think materials and suppliers and, well, the builders' merchants rather than the producers.
Yeah.
Are perhaps due a rationalisation, a slight element of restructuring anyway, because
that was beginning to happen anyway, wasn't it?
Well, during lockdown, one of the things they've done is they've shut their doors to visitors in their depots and stores, but still been doing site deliveries for online orders.
Yeah.
So there's been a shift, inevitably, in the past few weeks, an acceleration of the general shift to online ordering. Hmm. And if more and more people are ordering their building materials that way, I suspect that gives the builders' merchants scope for efficiency savings.
Yes.
Because they don't need so many, you know, customer service staff in the stores. It's more big
distribution centres,
warehouse,
I suppose.
Exactly,
yeah.
That,
yeah.
Which is,
yeah,
the way that retailers are going and everything's going. It's going online.
Well, yes. Well, as you say, that's probably an acceleration of a trend that was already happening. But it doesn't come at a particularly good time for employment, does it? That's pretty grim news, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's probably the most important and significant story of the week, but it's not, for my money, the most interesting, because it's in a sense, I suppose, I'm not very surprised about these horrible job numbers. But there was a more interesting story we ran earlier this week, was about a British company getting £100 million support from the UK government to build a road in Benin.
A British company,
in Africa. Well, it's it's registered in London. Its head office is in Broadgate Tower in London, and it's called Sogea Satom UK Limited. No, you're right. You alluded to it. It's not British at all. It's simply got a British post box in the offices of a law firm in London.
Yeah,
it has no employees in London, in the UK, as far as I can tell. It doesn't pitch for any work in the UK. It hasn't done any jobs in the UK. But it has persuaded the government that it's a UK company, because technically it is, and therefore UK Export Finance, which is the British government's export credit agency, has agreed to support it to the tune of £100 million for a road-building job in Africa. Now, this is not anything to do with a story that's in the national newspapers this morning about the Department for International Development, which gives money to overseas projects, aid projects in developing countries, which has just been abolished by or merged into the Foreign Office by the Prime Minister, they're announcing this morning.
Right.
The Department for International Development, that's a different organisation altogether and has its own controversies with whether it's giving money to sufficiently worthy causes or not.
Well, that's foreign aid. That's a different thing, isn't it?
Exactly that. Now, this sounds like a similar theme because it's, road building and UK Export Finance gives. It doesn't give money. It lends. It underwrites loans and it lends money to for projects. A lot of them sound like aid projects, infrastructure projects, hospital building projects, and so on, in developing countries. But this is part of the Department for Business, Enterprise, and Industrial Strategy. It's probably the Department of International Trade these days, but it's what used to be the DTI. It's a business end rather than the Foreign Office and Foreign Policy end of aid end of things.
But the beneficiaries are not foreign governments or foreign organisations. They're British companies.
UK Export Finance, its mission, and I quote, is to ensure that no viable UK export fails for lack of finance or insurance.
Yeah.
As its name suggests, its job is to promote British exports. That's what it's there for.
Yeah.
So quite why Sogea Satom UK Limited qualifies for this £100 million loan is something that I think questions need to be asked about.
I asked
the UK Export Finance organisation, how come this is happening? How much of this £100 million money is actually going to feed through to the UK? And they said that, well, 35 million worth of goods and services would be sourced from across the UK supply chain through the duration of this two-year project. Now, whether that means 35 million is going to go through the that Broadgate office of Sagir Satom UK Limited, or whether really they're going to be genuinely people who live, work and earn a living in Britain and pay British taxes are going to be involved in this Benin road job, I doubt. I would be really interested to hear in Britain is going to be involved in this Benin road job. And don't all shout at once, folks, when you come forward to tell me what you're doing.
So, it sounds like a funny way of helping UK businesses, which is to give £100 million to a foreign company in exchange for a promise to spend £35 million with UK suppliers. I mean, where's the other £65 million going?
Well, it's not an aid, it's a loan, so it's leveraging the money back into the UK. So it's not that the money's being spent, it's that it's being lent. But it's not what UK Export Finance exists for. Sagir Satom is a French company, part of Vinci. Vinci has big presence in the UK, but it's not like, had it been filtered through Taylor Woodrow Civil Engineering or something, we might have said, good old British company there, French-owned British company, is doing a road building job in French West Africa. But no, this is an entirely French bit of Vinci, or even French African bit of Vinci.
Yeah.
Sagir Satom's entire business is in Africa, Francophone Africa. The president of Sagir Satom, Jean-Michel Guillaud, forgive my pronunciation, Guillaud, said that, yeah, it's great the UK government's backing international trade in this way. We wouldn't have got this contract without it. And it's going to really help expand our overseas footprint. Well, they've already got a substantial overseas footprint. They've done lots of stuff in Benin already, building roads and the port of Cotonou.
I imagine that they're probably the go-to supplier, aren't they, out there in Benin?
Certainly one of them, I think, yes. Sagir Satom UK, this UK registered office, was only set up last year, not many months before they persuaded the UK Export Finance to sign, give them the loan to underwrite their project. It may well be that I'm misreading this, and it is perfectly good and proper, and Britain is going to benefit hugely. But I don't think so. There's form here. UK Export Finance and its predecessor organisation, Export Credit Guarantee Department, is what it used to be known as, have long been the subject of privatised type of stories about funding arms deals to Saudi Arabia and, the picking winners and back-scratching deals and dodgy behind doors goings on and so on. So it's always been, and it's ECGD, as was overhauled on the back of a lot of this. There are still, the only people asking questions, then people in authority that seem to be asking questions of UK Export Finance that I can find in recent times is the House of Commons Environmental Audit Committee. But what they're concerned about is UK Export Finance supporting fossil fuel projects in developing countries, backing dam or even dam constructions or coal-fired power stations or projects that perhaps shouldn't be backed. But no one is suggesting that there's a problem with UK Export Finance backing foreign-owned shell companies, which pretend to be British but aren't British. The honourable exception to the reporting of this, the Chartered Institute of Building, one of their magazines, Global Construction Review, ran an article on this broad topic about a year ago, February 2019. You Google it and I would guide people to read this. There's a lot more background on similar topics. A lot of what UK Export Finance does is support good and proper deals. For example, last year, Cleveland Bridge was supported to the tune of £49 million to build bridges in Sri Lanka. Now, a real cynic might say that Cleveland Bridge is actually a Saudi Arabian company owned by Al Rashid Group, and why are they getting support? But I don't go that far. I think Cleveland Bridge, it manufactures in the UK, it's got lots of British employees, it's got a strong UK heritage, and there's this question these days about what is a, what is the nationality of a company, what constitutes a British company. Cleveland Bridge, foreign owned but a British company. Sagir Satom UK Limited, slightly more towards
the edges. Yeah, they've hardly got a presence, have they, really? I don't quite understand. I mean, in the absence of any explicit explanation by Sagir Satom about what they intend to do and who they've been speaking to, UKEF suggests that there's a whole UK supply chain here just waiting for the money to flow through. But we don't know that. I'm assuming that probably this big road project in Benin was, planned, and Sagir Satom wanted the contract and were probably well placed to get it. They probably wanted a bit of money to fund the job itself and obviously make sure that they were going to be paid. And so I suppose that they spoke to UK Export Finance and said, would you help us with an export guarantee if we promise to channel all the money through a British supply chain? And maybe that's the way they got the help. Maybe the French government wasn't prepared to do the same thing. I don't know.
To quote the Coen brothers, would it be worth the simple? there is a history of these sort of deals being done. And there's nothing going through the UK. A couple of years ago, there was a Brazilian company and a Spanish company that do nothing in the UK, setting up post boxes in London law firms, or I think one was in a Leeds law firm office, but in UK law firm offices. One was for an airport revamp in Ghana, QG Construction UK, which actually is Quares Galvao, a Spanish company. Incorporated in the UK in 2016, quote, to pursue opportunities, design, build and invest in global infrastructure in emerging markets in partnership with UK and other European-based suppliers. Eurofinza UK, Ellipse Projects UK, one of those is French, one's Spanish. It just all seems very strange. There are, I think, British consultants involved, and there may be some, there are certainly some people benefiting. In digging around into all of this, looking at what UK Export Finance has been funding on the construction side of things, I came across a company I've never heard of before, NMS Infrastructure Limited, which, generally British company, incorporated for 10 or 20 years. Its principal activity is project management and delivery of social infrastructure projects in sub-Saharan Africa. And I was quite surprised that I'd never heard of this company, because I looked on its website. And in September last year, it had an item on its website saying it signed a €326 million contract with the government of the Ivory Coast to design and build and equip six hospitals, and a $210 million contract with Zimbabwe's Ministry of Health for other health centres and hospital facilities and so on. Now, a company signing contracts of this size, you'd imagine you might have heard of it. It's quite a big exporter.
Yeah.
Its latest filed accounts show a turnover of £14 million. That was financial 2018. The same in financial 2017. It's about the same. So this is a company turning over £14 million a year, claiming that it's signing €300 million, $200 million contracts. Now, I think playing fast and loose with exactly what they're doing. I suspect that they're either a consultant or a fixer or a 10%er.
Yes,
and doing valuable work, doing great jobs. But this is not aid, of course. This is business, and I'm just not quite sure that it's enough for all these companies to find a £14 million fix it company in the UK to access UK. Taxpayer support.
Yeah.
I think it needs investigating. I don't think that you or I are going to be listened to on this day, but I think we need to get wait until someone like, Panorama or Newsnight or something starts going, hang on a minute, how British are these companies? I mean, clearly the article in Global Construction Review a year ago, good as it was, failed to shake
any
leaves off the tree. So if anyone's listening out there who knows how to shake a tree, get shaking.
I heard something on the radio which made me sit up and take notice. This was before this story broke, but it also sounded a little bit questionable, which was about this fund which the government has set up to help companies which are struggling due to the coronavirus lockdown. And so far, I think about just over £16 billion has been paid out to companies to help them you know, sort of stay afloat sort of thing. And I assumed when that was announced that that would be predominantly for the more vulnerable type of companies and, you know, mainly SMEs, I assumed. Well, the biggest beneficiary so far, according to The Guardian, this is a German company, BASF, which does have 850 staff working in the UK. So they've got...
You get chemicals. It's a chemicals company.
Yes, that's
it?
A chemicals company. And also another major beneficiary is Bayer, a German drugs company. I'll read you a list, actually. It's quite a short list. BASF, Bayer, Chanel, Toyota, Nissan, Mitsubishi. Chanel actually has its global headquarters in London, which surprised me.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
It's a French cosmetics company. So, you know, these are companies which obviously can demonstrate some sort of UK interest. And you know, they employ a lot of people. Another one which is right up there with the Bayer and the Chanels is CNH, Case New Holland. It's no longer known as Case New Holland. The CNH Industrial, a Dutch company.
Are they part of Fiat? Is that right?
They certainly were, but their global headquarters is in the Netherlands. It's in Amsterdam. But they're registered in London for tax purposes. Now, they got £600 million from the UK government to help them get through the COVID-19 pandemic.
But my understanding, though, is that what the UK government money is in the job retention scheme is that's related to furloughing UK workers. I don't think that these companies are getting money for furloughing Dutch or German or French workers.
No. I mean, CNH
I don't have a problem with that. I mean, there is a direct correlation
between
UK employees and UK state aid.
Yeah.
That's fine. I mean, we know that Nissan and Toyota employ... No, it's Honda that scale back, isn't it? But Toyota in Derby, I believe, and
Nissan
up in Sunderland.
Yeah.
I have no problem with the government looking after those interests.
Yeah. It's CNH has at least two, I think possibly three factories in the UK as well. So again, they can demonstrate a genuine need.
I mean, as I mentioned earlier, there is this sort of vagueness about what is a British company. I mean, I grew up thinking of the Ford Escort was a British car, and then sort of thinking, actually, Ford's an American company. What, you know, you start to think, what is British car? What is a British company?
Yeah.
And in this global world, it's not that easy. But someone with a postbox in London isn't necessarily a British company. Anyway, David, what's been exercising my mind for this week is the rights and wrongs of British-UK export finance policies. what have you been busy with over the past week or two?
Well, the latest news is that we've still got a magazine and it was published, the June issue, combined May and June issue, was published earlier this week. So that's out. So I thought...
Mine landed on my doorstep yesterday, I think. And,
good.
It looks healthily substantial. Nearly 70-odd pages, which in the current climate is an achievement.
Yeah, not bad at all. As I say, we did take a breather in May because things were extremely uncertain at the time, but you know, things have stabilised a bit and things are looking good for the next couple of issues. The next issue, we always combine July and August, so we will be publishing the next issue in August. So I suppose for the second quarter of this year, we've been bi-monthly rather than monthly, but we should be back on our usual routine by August. So August and then September and monthly after that. But the June issue, though I say it myself, looks pretty good. We've got some interesting features in there. Got a nice cover story about Pooley Bridge, which is this the UK's first stainless steel road bridge, which was lifted into place at Pooley Bridge in the Lake District.
In the Lake District, is that somewhere?
Yes, it's in the Lake District. Oh, can't remember. I think, is it Derwent Water? It's at the head of Derwent Water.
Ullswater, I think, is it?
Ullswater, sorry, yes, Ullswater. Interesting job, very interesting bridge. The original stone bridge.
It's quite small, but it's a proper bridge. It's not like a footbridge.
Yeah, it's very elegant, and as I say, stainless steel, which is a bit of a novelty. The original bridge was a Grade 2 listed stone bridge, which was washed away in 2015 when there was a lot of flooding, as you may remember, completely ruined. I mean, they couldn't rebuild it. So they decided to replace it and do something completely different. So they built this stainless steel bridge, erected it next to the river, and then lifted it in one piece. So that's an interesting story. We've got a very interesting feature by our colleague Lisa Russell about Hyperloop. And Hyperloop is something which I was vaguely aware of, until I saw that actually Lisa was posting a lot of international news stories about Hyperloop, and I asked her to take a closer look for the magazine. And it's an idea which was, I suppose, crystallized is probably the best way to describe it, by Elon Musk, the Tesla and SpaceX entrepreneur. He had this idea of basically putting magnetic levitation, maglev. We have maglev light rail and that kind of thing already at airports and places like this. Sticking one of those inside an evacuated tunnel, basically. So it's a tunnel with a vacuum in it. And then shooting these trains or carriages through this tube at ridiculously high speeds. And
it's a bit like the way those wads of rolled up notes go from the supermarket till occasionally.
I don't know if they still do now. It's the same sort of thing. When you think about it, what's not to like? You've got magnetic levitation, so there's no physical contact between rail and wheel or anything like that. There aren't any wheels. It's basically floating on a magnetic force field. There's no air or very little air. It's not a perfect vacuum, I don't think. So there's no air resistance, and so you just use this magnetic levitation to accelerate these carriages, these trains, through these tunnels at speeds of up to
600 miles an hour. I'm reading 600.
Well, yes,
700 miles
an hour. I mean, nobody's got anywhere near that. I think about 300 miles an hour is the current record. There's several companies involved with this. I mean, Lisa spoke to a number of people. There are basically half a dozen companies or groups around the world that are looking into this. And
well, construction-wise, BAM are a big noise in this, aren't they? BAM in the Netherlands are involved in this.
Yeah, Arup and Virgin, they're usually in on these things. They're one of the groups which is active in this. There's a company called Zelleros in Spain, Hyperloop TT, which is sort of global, I suppose, US, France, Dubai, Spain, Brazil, Virgin Hyperloop One, SpaceX, of course, and a Dutch firm called Hart Hyperloop. Yeah, they're all working on different ideas and sort of putting their heads together. It's all sort of open sourced. So the idea, when Elon Musk first mooted the idea, I mean, I think he published a paper in 2013, it's as recently as that, and proposed a Hyperloop between San Francisco and Los Angeles, covering 350 miles in about 35 minutes, I think. That was his idea. They haven't built that.
Is his idea to get to Las Vegas quickly or to get away from Las Vegas quickly?
Well, this is one of the things. One of the interesting things about this is that, of course, when you're traveling, you're propelling quite a heavy thing through a tube at extremely high speeds. You can't have very sharp corners. So you need straight lines, and that really means long distances. So in the UK, I mean, Arup says that there is potential for Hyperloop in the UK, but we're still, you know, most of our urban centres are fairly closely spaced. So we've got a fairly good rail infrastructure. And of course, we've got HS2 to accelerate travel times between the north and the south.
I was going to say, is HS2 going to be anachronistic by the time it's finished?
Who knows? I mean, nobody's going to stop in midstream and say, well, let's not build a railway, let's build a Hyperloop instead. So HS2 will go ahead.
Of course it will.
Arabs say that maybe we could have a Hyperloop running alongside it. I can't see what the benefit of that would be. But certainly in places like, you know, the UAE and India, the United States and mainland Europe, yeah, there's potential for Hyperloop because you can have these long distances covered very, very quickly. And there are a couple of test tracks, well, several test tracks, actually, but most of them are sort of less than sort of 5 kilometres long. And as I said, the speeds attained so far are fairly modest. I mean, not modest by train standards. 350 miles an hour isn't slow. But, you know, that's less than half what Hyperloop should be capable of doing. It's quite interesting and is being taken very seriously. And there's potentially a lot of construction work involved if this takes off. So that's quite interesting. A bit hypothetical at this stage, but it's still very interesting. One of the other stories in the magazine this month, which I think is probably of more immediate concern to our readers, is a piece I wrote about recycling of plastic waste.
And yes, I read that. That's a very interesting
one. I wrote it. I shouldn't say. I say I wrote it. I wrote it with help from an organization called Sancroft, which is a recycling consultancy, and they first approached me with this idea. I knew nothing about it, but
can I just read you the quote which stood out, which I think for listeners will attract their attention, because it would be very easy to get embroiled in all the waste industry jargon and technical detail here. But the nub of this, you quote a chap saying, "A leading builder's merchant chain that currently spends £50,000 a year to recycle its plastic packaging, from 2023, in 3 years' time, they'll be paying over £1 million a year on recycling their plastic packaging." So the cost of that is going to go from £500,000 a year to £1 million for this company to recycle their plastic packaging. And I thought, okay, now you've got my attention. I had to sort of struggle a bit with all the acronyms and the jargon and the tax regimes and whatever. But the nub of it is, we got to do something about plastic.
Absolutely, yeah. Because those costs, I mean, contractors, you know, building firms don't pay for plastic packaging to be recycled. That is the responsibility of the people who produce the packaging and use it to package their products. But of course, that cost is embodied in the price you pay for the product. When you buy the product, you're paying for the packaging as well. And so if builders, merchants, and materials producers and people like that are going to have to pay these massively increased costs of recycling the plastic packaging that they produce, they're going to pass that on to building contractors, and you know that will trickle down. And it's a huge cost increase. There's going to be two things actually which will hike this. I mean, at the moment, and forgive the acronyms, there's a PRN, which is a packaging recovery note, which is the companies that come within the ambit of these plastic recycling obligation regulations 2007, they have to buy these certificates to demonstrate that they have paid for a certain minimum amount of plastic to be recycled. And the cost of these PRNs, plastic recovery notes, has gone up hugely and is continuing to go up. And then in a couple of years' time, there's going to be a new plastic packaging tax, which comes into force, it's April 2022. And that will be a tax on plastic packaging containing less than 30% recycled plastic. And anything with more than 30% recycled plastic in it will be taxed at a rate of £200 per ton. So that's a new tax which will come in. And then a year later, there will be a much more onerous cost introduced with the extended producer responsibility. And I mean, this goes not just obviously into construction, but into every sort of area of business.
Well, we know all about
really.
The McDonald's side of things, don't we? That's
well,
yeah. much in the news, and paper straws taking over from plastic straws and so on.
And supermarkets.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if
go on.
Not begin to shrink, if builders merchants can't or won't be shrink wrapping their stuff, how are they going to be delivering their products, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, brown paper bags, I assume. I don't. There must be people in the packaging industry working on this day and night, I should think, at the moment, because there has to be a solution. Certainly, somebody will have to do something about repackaging. I mean, in the olden days, when you ordered a ton of bricks, it came on the back of a lorry and it was tipped onto the site. There was no packaging involved at all. You just dug them out of the mud. Well, probably not quite as bad as that. But nowadays, of course, bricks and blocks come on pallets and they're all shrink-wrapped and they're, you know, reinforced with plastic tape and all the rest of it. So, you know, that's going to be a cost which becomes increasingly visible on the bottom line. So,
because presumably, if they come in not just pallets, if bricks came in a crate which has sort of wooden sides to it, you then got issues of how do you lift the bricks out? It becomes harder to lift them out. So you have a new materials handling challenge there as well, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, there are all
it's
sorts
not just
of
packaging,
possibilities.
It's also unwrapping. You know how you get the unwrapping them.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe somebody will introduce sort of reusable packaging. I don't know. Maybe your bricks will come in some sort of crate which you empty and then put on the doorstep like your old milk bottles, and then Marshalls comes along and collects it and refills it for you. I don't know. But it's quite remarkable that this will happen. And I'm amazed that I didn't know about it.
Or everything built in factories, You won't have building materials delivered to site. It'll all just be, just have your three components which you clip together on the building site, because it's all off-site construction.
Well, there we are. Yeah, there's something. Yeah, maybe it'll turbo boost the off-site sector. I don't know. That's an interesting thought, though. Yeah, building materials, a lot of them, like plasterboard, for example, you need to be protected from the weather. So if you're delivering a pallet of
plasterboard or something,
yeah, absolutely, you can't just leave it out in the rain. You've got to protect it. I don't know. Yeah, they reckon that the cost will increase. Well, as you said, times.
But what you've done in this article, my reading of it, is you've set the scene. You said, right, we know that something has got to change because of this situation.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to the follow up article. We can't write yet because we don't know what's going. But the industry's got to get its head together and say, right, how do we respond? Where do we go from here? And that's going to be the next interesting bit is, now what? Now what do we do? So, folks, get your issue of the June issue of the Construction Index, May June issue of the Construction Index magazine. Read this article by David and tell us how you think we can solve this conundrum.
I'm sure there are people out there who know far more about this already than we do. And if they're listening, I'd love to hear from them, because As you suggest, this is just the beginning, and I'm sure there'll be plenty more to say about it.
Excellent, excellent. What else?
So that's the magazine. That's the magazine. Anything else? Well, there was another topic which you reported on this week, which caught my eye. I thought it was rather interesting, and it was a French company again, but not doing anything in the least bit suspicious. Bouygues, the huge French contractor. They've just had tied up a deal with a paint company called AM Technology to use their product, which I believe is called Airlight. Tell us more about that one, Phil.
Airlight. Well, I rather mischievously called it Magic Paint. Bouygues to use Magic Paint. It does sound pretty magic to me. I'm no scientist at all, but the publicity material that Bouygues sent, it says, Airlight is an innovative and environmentally friendly paint. Okay, everything's innovative and environmentally friendly these days. But Airlight, it mimics nature, actively purifying the air by attacking and neutralising pollutants and microbes, providing a cost-effective solution for improved air quality when compared to green or living walls. So essentially, in application, it's a bog-standard paint. You get it in multitude of colours and put it on a, you know, pretty much any surface.
It's not quite like paint, though, is it, Phil? Because it comes in powder form. You mix it with water. You reconstitute it. Am I right?
Well, I don't know. I used to have paints like that when I was a kid.
Poster paints, they were called, weren't they?
That's it.
No, I had a look at their website, and unless I missed something, they actually come in powder form, and you add water, mix them up, and then apply them. But they're very clever paints, apparently.
It says, when it comes into contact with light, the paint becomes active, it says in capital letters, active, creating an ionized layer on its surface. This active layer works to purify the air around it, working in a similar way to plants using sunlight to turn carbon dioxide and water into oxygen. Airlight reverts pollutants back into harmless atmospheric gases and salts. In other words, it's photosynthetic paint. I've no idea. I mean, if we should put their stamp of authority on it, that's good enough for me. It must be kosher and do something good. But I do come from the school that if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah, I have to say, I can't help being cynical about this, because I mean the hyperbole surrounding it sounds just so implausible. I saw another news report about this, funnily enough, from Australia, which said that according to this company, the active ingredient is titanium dioxide. And I thought, titanium dioxide must be a remarkable substance. And why has nobody put it in paint before?
Well, it sounds like a bad guy. Is it not a bad guy?
Titanium dioxide.
Yeah. It's titanium dioxide. It sounds harmful for you.
Oh, I see. Oh, no, it's not. I mean, I don't know what it does, but I do know because I looked up. I looked it up on Wikipedia. Titanium dioxide is commonly used in paint. It's a white pigment. So it's used in paint because it makes it extremely brilliantly white. Now, apparently, looking at this manufacturer's website, they've got a whole section about their certifications. And there are some European standards out there, which I never knew existed, for active products which purify air. And they've been tested, their product's been tested against this. So presumably this is the sort of thing that has convinced Bouygues that, you know, this is kosher and this is worth investing in. But I can't believe that, I came away feeling that this is a nice paint which contains titanium dioxide, which happens to have this property of absorbing or converting pollutants into something less harmful when activated by sunlight, and that maybe there are loads of other paints which don't boast about this property but still possess it every bit as much.
So you're suggesting the active ingredient of airlite might be something that everyone else has already got already?
Well, if the active ingredient is titanium dioxide, then certainly, yes, because other paint manufacturers use it as a pigment. Then there might be more to it. There might be titanium dioxide and something else, in addition to that as well. I've no idea. But the idea of these, because this isn't the first instance I've heard of building materials claiming to be able to purify the air. Roof tiles was another one. I can't remember who produced them. It was some time ago. We reported on it. It absorbed something, or it converted something into something less harmful. And I'm sure that this is perfectly true. I mean, chemical reactions do take place, and very often they're catalyzed by sunlight and radiation, and they do their stuff. And one chemical comes into contact with another chemical in the presence of a catalyst, and something changes. So I'm sure that the science is there. Whether or not it's going to make any difference to our built environment or our impact on the environment, I have no idea. There was something, one claim which I saw for this paint, which is that it was at least as good at purifying 100 square meters of this paint was as good at purifying the atmosphere as planting 100 square meters of forest. And I think that's probably a claim too far. It just doesn't sound feasible to me. And I think most people actually would rather see 100 square meters of forest rather than 100 square meters of white paint. But there you go.
Well, maybe white paint. But if you're painting the Sistine Chapel or something rather beautiful.
Yeah.
there are some nice paintings in the world, David.
Oh, yeah.
You need to get out more. Visit some galleries.
Well, that's it. Well, Bouygues are convinced, and if anybody can explain the science to me, I'd be all ears. I'd love to hear about it. I'd love to know how this works. And if anybody has tested this paint, presumably they must have done.
Even if the paint's only a fractionally as environmentally beneficial as they make it suggest, it could be enough for a company, a contractor like Bouygues, when you're pitching for work with, I mean, they're suggesting this will be for education, university and school building projects, where the clients will be very, very keen on clean air and environmentally and sustainability and all this sort of stuff.
It'll tick a box.
It could mean the difference between them getting the contract over a competitor and not getting the contract,
which would be,
you know, one job will make it worth spending the money on this paint.
Yeah, I suppose so. And, you know, it does, I suppose it's a demonstration of Bouygues' determination to do what it can to reduce its carbon footprint, I suppose, and contribute towards a better environment. So, yeah, nothing wrong with that, I suppose. I don't know. The cynic in me tells me that it's a triumph of marketing over science. But if somebody knows better than me, I'd love to hear about it.
Now, may I change the subject quickly?
People
may have heard that rain, which I'd been hoping for when we first started talking and I thought was never going to come, it's coming here quite literally now in buckets.
Oh, fantastic. And it hasn't dropped. There hasn't been a single drop here, so I was completely wrong. You've got my weather, Phil.
Sorry for the rather more than pitter-patter you can hear in the background behind me, but I'm glad for it.
All right.
Any other business?
Well, I think nothing that I can think of. As I said, magazine-wise, we will be publishing again in August, and then the September bumper issue comes out with our annual Top 100. We're working on that already, by the way. So that's the magazine. Look out for it in August. And, of course, you will be producing a steady stream of news every day on the website, won't you?
It keeps going. In which case, thank you very much to everyone for listening. David, good to talk to you again.
And
I hope that you, if you've enjoyed listening to us, you'll tell some people about us. You can read everything we've been talking about, read more about it at theconstructionindex.co.uk, and you can subscribe to this podcast, Reconstruction, at all the usual places. Please do that. And get in touch with us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But not until next week, until 2 weeks' time, I'm afraid. This is me, Phil Bishop, and David Taylor saying, in nice thundery weather. See you next time.
Out with a bang.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing. We're currently offering a massive 80% discount on subscriptions to the Construction Index magazine. Order yours online today for only £1 per issue. Visit theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine to subscribe.